She could hardly believe her eyes when she saw it. Having returned late the night before from the week-long visit with her parents in the Berkshires, she had taken a bit longer that morning to get over to her precious little garden plot in the Fenway. She remembered the long years she had spent on the waiting list, patiently believing one day she would be granted the tiny plot of land that she could bring to life in her own special way. She remembered her incredible joy this past winter at being told this was the summer that she could make it a reality. She recalled the tiny seedlings growing under the grow lights of her cramped apartment, very special sign of life in the midst of the dreary gray spring that is so typical here in Boston. She recalled the careful cultivation of the little plot, particularly the painstaking care of transplanting this one very unique and special flowering plant that was to be the crowning centerpiece of her garden. Her mind went back to the ways in which it grew in almost a fickle manner at first, teasing her with days of looking limp and sad, then firm and robust, even joyful. And then that first bud appeared with the promise of color and texture and fragrance unequaled. Her friend had told her he was tending the garden well while she was absent, and now in the late morning sunlight, her lip quivered, tears began to form in the corner of her eyes, an unutterable sound was stuck in her throat. There it was, right next to her precious, beloved plant, the horrible weed she had been worried about and dreading and spending hours to make sure this very thing would never happen. And she knew from her grandmother's dedication to her own garden so many years in the past that this very weed was the one that couldn't be extricated from the soil next to the precious plant with its delicate buds without damaging the plant's roots so badly that it would destroy it completely. How could she live with this? What about all the hopes and the dreams and the glorious victory she had envisioned for herself? She'd seen herself on that pedestal, receiving the grand prize for the most beautiful presentation of a garden in Fenway. But now, with the weed showing itself right beside the flower, how could she ever recover from this humiliation, this grief, in her having to let go of her vision of what she needed to escape the great loneliness of not being recognized as the best of the best yet again? There is something in me that loves weeding. How about you? Isn't it just great to pull up those awful pests that grow right in the places you don't want them? Somehow, I feel my power, my strength, my ability to be validated and worthy is heightened as I dig out that dandelion, as I rip out that ragweed. Is it just me who feels so empowered by weeding? Maybe it was my upbringing in rural South Dakota. I remember the yearly task called walking the beans when the family needed to rise to the occasion, take our sickles and weed cutters down from their carefully constructed places in the barn where they hung the rest of the year and get out into those acres and acres of soybeans. The fields, because the beans were now too big to run the cultivator through. So, we needed to chop those weeds ourselves. They had to be removed, or the harvesting could never be successful. Maybe it was just that the sweltering heat, the oppressive humidity, which makes today feel cool, annoying gnats, relentless sun, could be forgotten when I played how powerful and effective I was at cutting down that milkweed, that nettle, that thistle over there, the cocklebur I see hiding in that next row. It rivaled the next most satisfying task, that of rock picking. Hurling those rocks up on the wagon as the tractor slowly moved over the plowed field. Where did they all come from, year after year? Were we raising rocks along with the crops? But oh, the relief in heaving that enormous one up onto the flatbed, moving along so slowly. Yet I always could hear, somewhere in the back of my mind, that gospel admonition. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Throwing stones can be dangerous. Wait, I think I see a really great one there, just perfect for throwing. Well, today's lectionary parable in Matthew of the wheat and the weeds drew my attention even then on those Sundays in our little German congregational church we faithfully attended, and it still does. Is it because it goes against my joy of weeding philosophy? The reign of God can be such a confusing thing, turning my assumptions and beliefs and even realities upside down. What can really be wrong with a good weeding out? Yet in this new world God is asking us to usher into being, we are told not to tear out the weeds, because it would also destroy the wheat. Even at the end of the age, we're told the angels will come to do the separation. We don't even get the satisfaction of doing it then. But this parable has always stuck in my mind and disturbed my spirit. Is it that while the parable itself gives great warning to those who would just love to weed out those other bad people, it might seem to give almost a tacit permission to the smug and self-righteous to say, "See, you are going to burn." But do I recall Jesus saying it's much easier to see the speck in another's eye than to see the log in my own? To see the causes of evil in another that need to be burned away rather than my own causes of evil? As the incredibly creative musical Wicked points out, there are very few at ease with moral ambiguities, so we pretend they don't exist. We think we like things simple, black and white, either or, them and us, weeds and wheat. God warns us of this when it comes to thinking that some of those people are expendable. In Jesus' day, widows and orphans, tax collectors and prostitutes, the least, the last, the lost. But Mary Oliver's poem, The Writers, addresses this ethic. When the Pony Express needed riders, they advertised a preference for orphans. That way, no one would ask questions when the carriers didn't arrive, or when the frightened ponies stumbled in with their dead from the flanks of the prairies. This detail from our country's past has no particular significance. It's only a footnote. There were plenty of orphans, and the point, of course, was to get the mail through. So the theory was sound. And besides, think of those rough, lean boys, how light and hard they would ride, fleeing the great loneliness. Orphans and widows and outcasts and you and me, all fleeing the great loneliness. Where is the place we can belong? The French philosopher and Christian mystic Simone Weil said, "When we encounter God's absence, our task is not to set out and replace what is missing, but to wait and allow God to find us and enfold us in God's great mercy and grace and love." Do we do our part in helping others and ourselves have the courage and wisdom to wait in the great loneliness, the great solitude that opens us to the great love? The great love that reminds us we are made in the image of God. The great love that seeks us out and asks us to drink deeply from the well of mercy and justice and hope. The great love from which we learn what is essential in life. You are my beloved, each a miracle in creation. Christer Stendahl, former dean of Harvard Divinity School, told us something about 35 years ago now that I will never forget. He said Jesus came and showed us that the line between good and evil was not just external and out there between them and us, but Jesus taught us to see that the line was also within us, woven into our very beings as created by God. Shadow and light, body and spirit, form and substance. And as our first hymn expressed, born of earth yet full of yearning, mixture strange of good and ill, from your ways so often turning, yet your love does seek us still. So when I look within and take time for silence, a silence in which I may begin to hear that which sound ordinarily obscures, when I take time for prayer and self-examination, I must learn to place myself before the one who loves me more than I can love myself, to draw upon God's compassion and unconditional love. It's in God's presence I gain the wisdom to see the difference. In order to see our faults and also our strengths as part of this great complex being God has made us, takes a sharp spotlight and demands of us a compassion we learn from God. Can we possibly learn to tolerate our own foolishness? Do we need to have a pathological certainty of our being right and justified in all things? Are we able to tolerate the loving and joyous and nurturing acceptance of God in all that we are? Good and ill, sweet and sour, like velvet and like steel? And can we accept that promise of God? You are my beloved in whom I delight. We may be released then from the constant need for validation, the scurrying about for vindication, the dwelling upon our victimization. Because the ability to work for our own good despite all the less than admirable things we know about ourselves is closely connected to the ability to work for your neighbor's good, despite all the less than admirable things you know about him or her. We've all heard that prayer, at times attributed to Reinhold Niebuhr: God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It seems Jesus warns us of the tendency we have of changing those weedy people around us, or those weedy places even within us, so we won't have to go back to God for help to restore us when we find we haven't been able to construct the perfectly controlled universe which our egos had convinced us we desperately needed. But our souls always knew better. Our souls grow in the wisdom as we let God teach us the difference between changing one another and loving one another. Quite a difference. Gandhi once said that 80% of the world's violence comes in the form of unrequested advice. Why is it I can know so well what you need to burn away, and I can't see the parts of me that would be better ignored, and the weeting? Instead of weeding, what about weeting? Noticing the wheat, the fruits of the Spirit God keeps giving me, patience or kindness or love or generosity, hope. Amazing what can happen when I start noticing that other side. But because God loves us so deeply and fiercely and fully, we can rest in that love when all else falls away. Our inflations can be perceived and surrendered. Our resentments can be released. The burden of our grasping and exploiting self can be laid down. Here God offers us another way. Again, Mary Oliver. I worried a lot. Will the garden grow? Will the rivers flow in the right direction? Will the earth turn as it was taught? And if not, how shall I correct it? Was I right? Was I wrong? Will I be forgiven? Can I do better? Will I ever be able to sing? Even the sparrows can do it, and I am, well, hopeless. Is my eyesight fading, or am I just imagining it? Am I going to get rheumatism, lockjaw, dementia? Finally, I saw that my worrying had come to nothing and gave it up and took my old body and went out into the morning and sang. She could hardly believe her eyes when she saw it. All together in one place, in one great congregation, shining bright as the sun. The lost and the lonely, the broken and breaking, the wishing and wondering, skin of shining black and translucent white, glowing yellow and fiery red, golden brown and shimmering bronze, male and female and transgendered and queer and questioning. She had ears that now heard. She had eyes that now saw. The poor were rich. The weak were strong. The foolish ones were wise. Outcasts belonged, and those who perished had risen, indeed. Every burden had been laid down, every tear had been wiped away, and in the sheer silence, she heard what she vaguely remembered from somewhere very, very long ago, the melody of the stars, the melody of peace. She could hardly believe her eyes and ears, and she was lost in wonder, love, and praise. In such a world of star and seed, of breath and beauty, of work and wonder, of justice and joy, just how can we keep from singing?